This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and there is big news here in the Commonwealth today on the pandemic. Governor Charlie Baker announced that he will move adults age 65 and older up in priority for vaccines to the second group of phase two. He also said that residents age 75 and older are going to start receiving their vaccines on February 1st. Now, we also have a big headline for you today in that we are waiting any time now to speak live with Dr. Anthony Fauci from Washington. However, he is understandably not available to us right this minute because he's still on a call with the White House. So we are going to start with WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg, who's going to tell us a little bit more about where we are with vaccines in the Commonwealth and what comes next. Carrie, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana. And I'm sorry I'm not Anthony Fauci. I can't wait to hear him.
Me too, Carrie. So what we'll do is when Dr. Fauci is ready for us, we'll just take a break from you. We'll go back to Dr. Fauci, have that conversation, then we can come back to you again after. Sounds good?
Yes, that would be an honor to cede my heir to him.
Excellent. So, Carrie, we'll hear a little more from Steve Brown later in this in the hour about the headlines from the governor's press conference today. I do want to ask you, we've had a lot of conversation statewide over the last several days about how Massachusetts ranks overall in the rollout. Lots of criticism that we've been slow. So where do we stand compared to other states?
Well, I would say we're not awful, but we're below the national average, which is not what we expect as a state that likes to think of itself as sort of a medical mecca. According to the Bloomberg vaccine tracker, Massachusetts has administered about 6 vaccines per every 100 residents, and the national average is a bit higher. It's 6.8 per 100 people. And the state, according to these latest figures, has actually used just under half of the vaccines that have been delivered. So both of these numbers are below the national average.
Okay, and Carrie Goldberg, thank you for that answer. But stand by, please, because we now have Dr. Anthony Fauci on the line, and I will turn our attention to him. Dr. Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and advisor to 7 presidents, including President Joe Biden. We know you're very busy. Thanks for joining Radio Boston.
Good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Fauci, all year, for a year now, we've been regularly having to ask the question, how bad is it? Where are we right now in America, here in New England, when it comes to this pandemic?
Well, I think the numbers speak for themselves. We have now 420,000 deaths in this country. Looks like we are plateauing a bit with that very acute inflection surge that we've seen over the last couple of months emanating from the point where we entered into the really cold season. And we had, you know, Halloween, we had Thanksgiving, and then we had the Christmas and New Year's holiday, and we had a very steep slope. Thankfully, it is now beginning to plateau and the cases are starting to come down a bit, but they're still in a zone that's very troublesome. I mean, where you're having a couple of 100,000 or between 1 and 200,000 new cases a day, which will always lead to hospitalizations and deaths. So in that respect, that's some reasonably good news. But the thing that counters it, that is more sobering, is that we now have to deal with mutants, you know, some of which are already in the country. You know, the UK has a mutant that looks like it transmits more efficiently, therefore more people would get infected. And recently they've come out saying that it is even a bit more deadly in the sense of a greater degree of virulence, which means it can harm you, make you sicker, or even kill you. We have 22 states in the United States that already have this mutant, and it likely will become dominant in some respects over the next couple of months. So on the one hand,
when you say dominant, Dr. Fauci, excuse me for interrupting you, but when you say likely become dominant, do you mean that it is the form of the coronavirus that will be most prevalent, the highest rate of infection?
Right. Yeah, that's the terminology that you use in virology. When you say the dominant strain, you mean it's the one that percentage-wise is causing most of the infection. So, for example, the South African strain that is now a really very, very, very serious problem in South Africa. It is the dominant strain there, which means almost everyone who's getting infected with SARS-CoV-2 in South Africa is getting infected with their mutant strain.
So, Dr. Fauci, as I'm listening to you, I can hear, I can feel our listeners' collective heart rate rising because those are some scary things that you're laying out there. I think I want to ask you a couple of questions and follow up from that.
But let me unscare them a bit. I mean, I don't want them to be complacent. But remember, the vaccines that we have work against the wild type virus and also against the mutants. Even though the mutants diminish somewhat the overall efficacy of the vaccine against the South African strain, there's still enough cushion in that, that overall the vaccines that are now being distributed in the United States, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, work against the mutants as well as against the wild type. So the message is, this is all the more reason when vaccine becomes available to you to get vaccinated, because the best way to protect against the evolution of viruses into mutants is to prevent them from replicating. And the way you do that is you diminish the rate of infection in a given country. And that's the reason why the best news is to let, if vaccine becomes available to you, get vaccinated.
So, Dr. Fauci, when listeners hear news like today that Moderna is going to explore a booster shot because the efficacy of the vaccine against the South Africa strain is lower, you still want people to understand it may be lower. We may be having to investigate this, but those vaccines are still acceptably effective, correct?
Absolutely correct. And that's what people need to understand. So if you know, we talk about a cushion effect. So if you need a certain titer of a antibody to protect you against a virus, and you diminish that somewhat, and you are still well above the critical level that you need, even if you diminish it somewhat, you're still well within the safe zone. And that's what we mean by saying, even though we're following very carefully the evolution of these mutants, we are still, from the vaccines that we have, in a zone that would still protect us. So the sooner we get people vaccinated, the better off we are.
So, Dr. Fauci, to that point, to the question of vaccinations, I want to play a little sound for you right now. This is Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, our governor, earlier today when he was announcing 103 vaccine rollout sites that'll come online by the middle of next month. But he said to expect some open appointments if we don't get more shipments from the federal government. Here he is.
We are overbuilding here with respect to what we anticipate we're going to get from the feds by the time we get to the middle of February. And I certainly hope I'm wrong about that. And I hope that the feds give us the vaccine that we'll need to actually make sure that every single seat and every single appointment can get filled. But we can only move as fast as the federal government ships vaccines to the Commonwealth.
So then, Dr. Fauci, we had a letter from a top state health official saying the supply here in the Commonwealth will probably be limited through the middle of next month. You made some comments over the weekend referring to supply as, quote, the most limiting constraint early on, end quote. Do we have a real vaccine supply problem in the United States? And if so, what does that mean and what do we do?
Well, for localities like Boston and a state like Massachusetts, which has done a really good job in being able to put up a structure to be able to vaccinate. Indeed, the supply will not meet the demand because you have the capability, but that's not uniform throughout the country. And I think that's the reason why you see the discrepancy where in some places you have what your governor just said about needing to get more vaccine because they have slots there to fill and to get people vaccinated. And there are other areas of the country where you have vaccine lying around and they don't have the capability of getting it into people's arms. We've got to correct that. And in fact, if you listen carefully to what President Biden has said on multiple occasions, is that we're going to do everything we possibly can to increase the availability of vaccines, to use the Defense Production Act to get the kinds of supplies that are important for the development of vaccines, for the administration of vaccines, to make it as efficient as one possibly can. He's paying attention to that literally on a moment by moment basis. I can tell you that as a fact, because we've had multiple conversations with him about that. So where there are problems, we have to fix them. That's the point.
Dr. Fauci, is there a point at which you expect us to reach some kind of equilibrium where, you know, what state-by-state capacity is and what the government is able to deliver hits a balance? And how far out would that be?
You know, it's out a month or two or three. I mean, as you get into February and then February to March and then March to April, there'll be more and more. And I believe as the most, I would say, if you look at the restrictions we had very early on, they were rather profound. They got less and less. When you have capabilities like Boston and the state of Massachusetts has of being able to put the vaccines into people's arms, the discrepancy between supply and demand looks more acute and profound, where in other areas it doesn't. All that having been said is that as we get into February, March, April, and May, it will ease up. I can tell you that because there will be much more availability of vaccines than we have right now.
So, Dr. Fauci, I know you've talked about President Biden's statements, and he has said that he wants to get us as a country to 100 million vaccinations in 100 days. So two questions for you. The first is, how essential is his $1.9 trillion stimulus package to making sure that happens? Because we do understand it's not clear that that package can pass in Congress.
Well, I really hope it does, because it is a package that is critical to getting us out of where we are right now and getting us back on track of getting this thing under control. A $1.9 trillion package is a package that is critical. You know, something like $415 billion of that is directly involved in addressing COVID. So we need the money. I would hope that the Congress comes through with it.
So, Dr. Fauci, there's a lot more I'd like to ask you there, but we have limited time with you. I do want to touch on a couple of other things. I want to touch on the gap between the percentage of Americans who say they're prepared to be vaccinated and the percentage of Americans we need to be vaccinated to reach herd immunity, based on the polls that you pay attention to and the percentage of the population you believe we need for herd immunity. How big is that gap and how do we close it?
Well, let's take a look at what the estimate is. You know, we don't know exactly what we need, but we can make some extrapolations from measles and what's required for herd immunity for measles, which is, you know, somewhere around 90%. Once you get into the 80s, you lose somewhat of the herd immunity protection. That's based on the degree of transmissibility of measles as well as the efficacy of the vaccine. If you use those parameters to make an estimate for what you would need for SARS-CoV-2 herd immunity, I would say, even though we have to be modest enough and humble enough to know that we don't have the exact answer, I believe it's somewhere between 70 and 85%. So when you have, you know, 20, 30, 40% of a population somewhat hesitant to get vaccinated, if they don't get vaccinated, that's going to be that much more difficult. It doesn't mean you're not going to get a reasonably good effect of vaccinating people, but it means you're not going to be able to essentially shut down the virus the way herd immunity would allow you to do. So the solution to that is to do some serious community outreach to get to the people, particularly among minority populations, understanding and respecting the reasons for their hesitancy, but try to convince them by utilizing people that they trust, people in the community that look like them, that understand them, to go out and to talk about the necessity of getting vaccinated, not only for your own protection, but for the protection of your family and actually the protection of your entire community.
You know, you did a Zoom meeting with Reverend Liz Walker and the 12th Baptist Church community here in the greater Boston area right around Thanksgiving last year, addressing historic mistrust of the healthcare system and communities of color. You agreed to appear here on Radio Boston. It sounds like you are taking this outreach to convince people to get vaccinated very personally.
I am. And the reason I am is because, you know, I'm a physician as well as a scientist and a public health official. And I see firsthand the extraordinary and painful disparities in health. It would be really tragic in my mind that the brown and black people who suffer disproportionately from the disease for reasons that are understandable, but nonetheless are not justifiable now, for them not to afford themselves the protection of a highly efficacious and safe vaccine. It would be, you know, doubly painful and tragic for them. A, they disproportionately suffer from something, and yet they have a tool that can protect them. And if they don't utilize that tool, you know, that makes me very sad. And that's the reason why I spend a considerable amount of personal time. I mean, every day, a day does not go by where I don't spend a considerable time measured in hours in trying to get the minority communities to get vaccinated, be it on a radio show here with you, with some of the black churches, with the congressional black and Hispanic caucuses, whatever I can do to get the message out, I would do.
And in our last minute or so, I know your time is limited. You oversee everything, the whole country, and I know each region is different. You mentioned that. What is imperative in Massachusetts right now? What do you want listeners here in New England to know or do after having had a chance to hear you today?
Well, I mean, it's an advantage because you're dealing with a city and a state that has really done a very good job with a governor who understands the situation. You know, during the Trump administration, when we used to have meetings with the governor, I had with the governors, entirety of the governor population, I've had back and forth in discussions with your governor multiple times. And he understands the situation. He understands it both from a public health standpoint, from a scientific standpoint, as well as from the need of vaccination. So the message is abide by the public health measures. Don't give up. Don't get discouraged. We all know that there is a degree of understandable fatigue. We refer to it as COVID-19 fatigue. It's there. But things will get better as we get more and more people vaccinated. You know, my message to the people of Massachusetts, particularly of Boston, is hang in there because it will improve. But it will improve because we adhere to public health measures and because we get vaccinated. And I have a very special interest. I went to school in Massachusetts. My daughter lives in Massachusetts. So go ahead, Massachusetts, and do it right.
All right, that's Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and advisor to seven presidents. Dr. Fauci, thanks for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Pleasure. Good to be with you.
Governor Baker addressed concerns over the pace of the vaccine rollout here in the Commonwealth earlier this afternoon. Baker says that increasing the speed of the rollout will rely at least partially on more doses becoming available in Massachusetts.
We're setting up the capacity to administer far more doses than we are currently receiving or projecting to receive from the feds. What this means is if we continue to get the same number of doses we're getting now, we may end up with some empty sites and some empty seats and empty appointments at some of our sites.
Now, before the break, we spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Diseases. He addressed the federal level of this. You also heard us talk for a moment with Kerry Goldberg, who we will check back in with about the state of rollout in the Commonwealth in a few minutes. But right now, we have Senior State House reporter Steve Brown joining us to give us a little more on Governor Baker's press conference just a couple of hours ago. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So, Steve, what is the biggest headline? I know the governor said a lot today.
Yeah, definitely. Starting Monday, people over the age of 75 can begin getting vaccinations. Also, the state is moving up in the queue anyone over the age of 65. They'll be in part two of phase two. They had been lowered down in eligibility, but the state is now moving them up, reflecting the recommendations by the CDC and the Biden administration. Also, they plan to have 103 vaccination sites online by the end of this week, and that'll go up to 160 sites by the middle of February.
So, Steve, the governor talked about how many people the state has the capacity or will build the capacity to vaccinate. He also noted that's different from the number of actual doses given to individual people. Can you talk about that for us? It's not the same thing, capacity and what we've done, right?
That's correct. The governor has said all along that the wild card in this whole process is how much vaccine the state gets from the feds. He's expressed frustration that they don't know how much vaccine they'll get until a week before they get it, making it kind of hard to plan ahead. So while they can plan to have many vaccination sites around the state, if they don't have the vaccine available to give out, it becomes a moot point, and everyone just gets frustrated and mad.
Okay, but there are still some doses in the Commonwealth that haven't been distributed. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. There are some doses that haven't been distributed. The state's trying to get a better handle on it. They're realizing that some sectors in Phase 1 were given a certain allotment of vaccine, but that the demand in those particular segments wasn't as great as first anticipated for various reasons. So that vaccine was distributed has been sort of in a state of limbo, ready to go into the arms of eligible recipients, but there haven't been enough eligible recipients to get them. To date, most of the vaccine has gone out to hospital healthcare systems. This week, the state decided not to ship out any more vaccine to those facilities, telling them instead to use up what they have on hand.
And once it goes to a system that's going to distribute it, whether it's a hospital, Steve, or it's a CVS, let's say, or a Walmart, does the state really turn it all over to that entity then? Who makes sure the doses actually get in arms?
Yeah, the Baker administration says it is constantly monitoring the scheduled clinics, and they have told providers that they need to utilize what they have on hand, and if they don't, the state will step in to redistribute those vaccines to other providers.
All right, I want to play a little sound for you. We heard a lot of talk in the press conference today about equity and how the slower rollout is at least partially due to targeting vulnerable populations. That's what the governor says. But there has been pushback over the location of vaccine sites. I think actually you may want to tell us a little more about this sound and then you can have us play it. Go ahead.
Sure. There's been plenty of criticism that the vaccination sites to date have not been targeting Black, Brown, and Latino communities, which have been disproportionately hit hard by COVID. Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters today spoke to that, saying that the state's priority is to ensure that the lens of equity is reflected in the allocation and distribution.
Going forward, it is our expectation that retail pharmacy locations must prioritize Chelsea, Revere, Mattapan, Dorchester, Roxbury, and municipalities outside of Boston with communities disproportionately impacted by COVID.
And in addition to those pharmacies, the state is opening up a mass vaccination site at the Reggie Lewis Center in Roxbury.
So, Steve, I think you heard Dr. Fauci before the break. He was really quite complimentary towards the end there about Governor Baker and the way he has handled things here in the Commonwealth. But the governor has undergone a lot of criticism in the last week, especially for who is getting a vaccine when, how fast we're doing it, et cetera. Was today's press conference essentially the governor's response to those criticisms?
Yeah, it was. Over the weekend, stats came out showing that per capita, Massachusetts hasn't been doing as well as other states in getting the vaccine into the arms of citizens. Baker and Sutters say that Massachusetts prioritized employees and other groups who have been historically marginalized that other states didn't prioritize. It's not so much how many doses have been given out, but who has received it. Healthcare workers, health aides, personal care attendants, homeless people. The governor said those populations were not only vulnerable, they're also hard to reach.
And Steve, just briefly, any big unanswered questions right now?
Yeah, I guess it's how soon the new administration in Washington can get their sea legs on this and begin working in tandem with the states, making sure that they get the amount of vaccine that they need.
All right. That is WBUR senior state house reporter Steve Brown. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So let's turn back now to WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, thank you so much for sticking with us from the beginning of the show. Carrie?
Yes, I'm with you.
Great. We lost you there for a second, but we had you when we really needed you at the beginning of the show. So now you heard us talk to Dr. Fauci. You heard Steve's debrief of the press conference just now. Let me just start by getting your reactions on all of it.
Well, I think my biggest reaction is that we're entering a whole new phase of vaccination in which the biggest constraint is going to be supply from the federal government. So we, you know, up until now, we were in kind of first gear and we were getting the people who were absolutely the most vulnerable or most necessary, like the people who keep the healthcare system running. Now we're in this great big scale up to what is really an attempt at mass vaccination. And the most critical factor becomes, as we've been hearing, the supply of vaccine that we can get from the federal government. So I think what stuck with me most from Dr. Fauci was he was a little bit mushy about, like, well, you know, the vaccine will be coming February, March, April. There will be more. President Biden is asking for more than $40 billion that will all go towards fighting the coronavirus. But it left me feeling like, you know, there are quite a few unknowns going into this late winter, early spring about when all the vaccinations will actually happen.
Yeah, so it feels, Carrie, like in the last 48 hours or so, vaccine supply has really entered our conscious as the key thing to be worried about. If we roll back the clock 72 hours and further back from there, there was tremendous pressure on the governor about the fact that the Commonwealth rated, for example, 29th across states in terms of per capita vaccinations. And he had been arguing that there was this deliberate phased plan he had, and that over time we'd be glad for that, even if it meant we were slow at the beginning. Is that why we've been slow, or were there capacity issues that also put us behind?
Well, you're exactly right. He's presenting this interesting explanation because many of us were kind of mystified. Like, we're so good at medical things. We're not dumb about logistics. Why would we not be at the front of the pack? And the explanation that we're now getting is, well, we targeted these very vulnerable populations. And I felt like the subtext today from Governor Baker and from Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters was that the state was doing all it could, but some of the institutions that got the supplies of the vaccines didn't dole them out quickly enough. Or actually, the thing that struck me most was that in long-term care, in nursing homes, these state officials said about 80% or more of the residents are getting the vaccines, but only about 50% of the staff. So it sounds like they're running into some vaccine hesitancy that ends up meaning that the vaccine supplies that go to some institutions don't actually get used. They don't get administered. So that's what we're hearing now, is this explanation that the strategy that they chose on a sort of ethical basis has led to delays, which kind of puts a different face on what many of us were wondering might just be inefficient handling of the vaccines.
All right, so then that raises a question, because we now know from the governor that people over 75 will be able to begin registering for vaccines on Wednesday, and on February 1st will be able to start getting them. Close on their heels will be residents age 65 and older. That's a lot of people. Are we going to be able to keep up with that, or are we going to get further behind when more people are eligible for vaccination?
Well, I think the point isn't so much do we get behind or not. The point is just ramping it up as quickly as possible. And I think for all of us, just knowing that you might make an appointment on Wednesday or afterwards and get the appointment, but then if there's no vaccine to be had when it comes time for your appointment, you might get bumped. And so I think it's good to just set expectations that way.
All right. And tell us a little more, Carrie, about vaccination sites.
So there are just going to be dozens and dozens of them. They will be in pharmacies. They will be in stadiums. They will be in supermarkets. They will be in community health centers. They will be in all different places. And the key will be for people, when they're eligible, to go to the central state registration system, find a vaccine site near you, and sign up for that specific site.
And how did the governor today, or how are we addressing the questions that we've been hearing, Carrie? We had folks from La Colaborativa and Chelsea on the air last week about concerns that while there are vaccination sites being stood up, they're not easily accessible to those people of color and essential workers who might be most vulnerable to the pandemic.
Right. And what we're hearing from state officials is that they really are prioritizing equity. They're putting an extra 20% of sort of vaccine access into communities where there's been a particularly high level of coronavirus cases. And so clearly, government officials are trying to address this. And I think also, you know, the fact that you can sign up online and find a local vaccine site also is meant to address the problem of people needing to have convenience when they get their vaccines.
And yet still carry some criticism that there's not a centralized registration site here in the Commonwealth like there are in some other states.
Yes, and actually Governor Baker got a bit snippy about that today when he spoke. He said pretty much like, look, how streamlined do you want this to get? Like you go to the state website, mass.gov COVID-19 vaccine, you look at a map, you find a vaccination site near you, you click on it and you get an appointment. So even though it's not one central registration site, it is all in one place once you choose your local vaccination. Here's what he sounded like today.
You can go on the website, determine if you're eligible, on the site, find a location that's providing vaccinations that's convenient to you, click on it, make an appointment.
No plans to streamline that, though.
How much more streamlined would you like it to be than that? That's pretty, look, I think that's, for most people, being able to determine if you are eligible, where the site closest to you might be, and how you can make an appointment on that site, all at the same time, should be, for most folks, a pretty easy way to make that happen.
Now, Tiziana, you can hear he's getting a little defensive there, but it really does sound easy. It's just that I think to me it's one more example of how each state is having to reinvent the wheel on so many things connected to the pandemic. And I think we can just hope that some of that could change now with the Biden administration and its plans to funnel tens of billions of dollars into fighting COVID-19.
So, Carrie, we've talked about a lot in a short period of time here, taken in a lot of information. What are kind of your biggest takeaways from the governor today?
Well, I think the overarching feeling that I got is that we're getting into second gear with our vaccinations as of next week. You know, where first gear was kind of making sure the medical system kept running, long-term care places that got hit hardest were more protected. Now we're heading into the really mass phase with all of our 75-year-olds and above and 65-year-olds and above getting their shots. This is a truly massive scale-up where we really see the sort of historic level of vaccination and multiple sites that can handle thousands of people a day, pharmacies, supermarkets, it's vaccinations everywhere. So now we're heading into the really big time as of next week.
And what are you going to watch most closely going into that really big time, Carrie?
I'm most watching two main things. The vaccine hesitancy that Dr. Fauci spoke about earlier. I mean, the fact that 50%, only 50% of nursing home staffs are getting their vaccines is stunning to me when you consider how many deaths there have been in nursing homes. So there's a lot of staff members who have seen people die around them and yet are deciding not to get the vaccine. That, to me, bespeaks a level of misinformation or disinformation that is going to take a lot of effort to counter. And then, of course, the other main thing to watch is the vaccine supply. When Dr. Fauci spoke, I most wondered, okay, we're bringing in the Defense Production Act. How much of a difference will that make to our supplies of vaccines? So those are the two biggest questions for me in the weeks to come.
All right. That is WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg with lots of help and information for us today. Carrie, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Tiziana.
For most of the show today, we have talked about the coronavirus and vaccines, but now we are going to shift gears because now that former President Trump is out of the White House, facing backlash from this month's Capitol insurrection, looking at a second impeachment trial next month, we want to ask what is next for the GOP. The party faces a potential fissure between those who would return their focus to pre-Trump principles and those who would finish the remake of the Republican Party in Donald Trump's image. So the question is, who will prevail? And will that be different here in New England than it might be in other parts of the country? We want to know what you think. Where should the Republican Party land on these questions? How about the Commonwealth, New Hampshire? Will it land in the same place as other regions? And with popular, more centrist governors like Charlie Baker and Chris Sununu, is there a chance that it will do things differently or maybe break from the party in other parts of the country? We take your thoughts on all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800. 1-800-423-TALK. Now, joining us today for this conversation is Jennifer Horn, who is the former chair of the New Hampshire GOP and a co-founder of the Lincoln Project, a group of former Republican operatives who waged a tough anti-Trump campaign during the 2020 election, and WBUR's Anthony Brooks, who has been following the evolution of the Republican Party under and now after Donald Trump. Hello to both of you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, Tiziana.
Great to be here.
Great to have you both.
And hello,
Jennifer. I'm going to start with... Yeah, you two know each other, right?
We do.
A little bit. We've had some nice conversations in recent weeks. Yeah, good to hear yours.
Yeah. Excellent. So let's jump in. And Jennifer, I will start with you. You left the Republican Party formally in December. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, a lot of people, you know, have asked me over the years, how can you stay? How can you continue to be a part of that party? And for me, it was always about the founding principles of the party, you know, and I always said, I'm not going to be bullied out of my party by Donald Trump and the likes of Donald Trump. But what happened that changed, and I always had this apparently naive hope that when Trump was behind us, that there would be a resurgence, at least in part, of principled, positive, uplifting leadership in the Republican Party. But what we saw happen instead is when Donald Trump lost, which gave the Republican Party the opportunity to kind of step into that moment and say, good, he lost. This is not who we are. We're going to put him behind us and try to, you know, try to rebuild and remake ourselves. Instead, what they did was they fully embraced everything that was the worst about Donald Trump and said, we are going to build our future on Trumpism. And we saw that come out in the manner in which Republican leaders across the country contributed to, advanced, fanned the flames of the lie about this election, and then participated in an effort to overturn the legitimate results of an election in the United States of America. I'm one who would look at people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and say that these people are seditionists and they need to be held accountable. But when I saw that the entire party was looking at Trumpism and saying, we don't want to put it behind us, we want to build our future on that, it became clear that there was simply no place anywhere in the future in the Republican Party for me.
So, Jennifer, I'm going to turn to Anthony here. Anthony, I want to both ask you how you describe the challenge facing the Republican Party now, especially here in our region, and also just to ask you to confirm, most polls do demonstrate what Jennifer said, which is that the majority of Republicans continue to support Donald Trump and want a party that is aligned with him, correct?
Yeah. Let me respond to that last part first. So I'll just cite the results of a couple of recent polls. An NPR PBS Marist poll, which was released last week, 70% of Republicans believe Biden was not legitimately elected. We know that that's not true, but 70% of Republicans believe that. And according to a Washington Post ABC poll, solid majorities in the party believe that Trump bears little or no responsibility for the attack on the Capitol. We've got tape. We've all seen it where he is basically egging those people on, inciting them, telling them to march down to the Capitol and fight like hell. In terms of, you know, where the party stands right now and the challenge it faces, you know, I think Jennifer Horn expresses it really well. If the party is no longer a home to principled conservatives like Jennifer Horn, I think the party has a problem. And, you know, my question is, and a lot of people are asking this, can the party go on, continue to be a home for principled conservatives like Mitt Romney, like Charlie Baker, like the kind of conservative that Jennifer Horn is, and the sort of rabid Trumpist core supporters of the president? I mean, how do they coexist? And I think Jennifer's answer is they cannot. And so she left the party. And I think that, you know, represents a huge challenge for this party going forward.
So let me just throw the number out, because in a minute I'm going to start taking calls. 800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Before I go to our first caller, Jennifer and Anthony, I do want to ask you, and I don't know if you know what the answer is, do we have information about whether Republicans in the New England region, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Maine, Vermont, agree with the larger polling numbers Anthony just gave us? Are they as dedicated to Donald Trump as Republicans in other parts of the country? Do either of you know?
Well, I can take a sort of quick stab at that answer. The short answer is I don't know because I haven't seen recent polling. But it is instructive to look at, for example, the Massachusetts Republican Party. The party leadership just reelected Jim Lyons as party chairman. Jim Lyons has been a pro-Trump Republican. The deputy party chairman, Tom Mountain, also very, very pro-Trump. They are wildly sort of out of step with some of the more moderate Republicans. And let me play some tape from one of those people. I think we have this standing by Tiziana. So this is Anthony Amore. He ran unsuccessfully for Massachusetts Secretary of State in 2018. He is in favor of the impeachment of Donald Trump for a second time. And he calls Trump's incitement of a riotous mob an affront to the Constitution and to a nation of laws. So here's what he told me.
We should work on rebuilding our party as a party of republicanism and conservatism and away from the idea of this cult of personality with an allegiance to one person rather than the country or the rule of law.
But his party in Massachusetts essentially disagrees with that. Jim Lyons has been pro-Trump for his entire tenure. He's talked about he supported Trump's claims at least early on that this election was stolen from him and that he should have the right to challenge it. And this went on for quite a while. So, again, we get back to that question. How do the Anthony Amores of the world find a place within that Republican Party?
Jennifer Hearn, anything to add to that before I take a call?
Well, sure. You know, I haven't seen any polling that is New Hampshire specific or Massachusetts specific or anything like that either to this specific question. But what I would say that, you know, kind of to build on what Anthony just said, New Hampshire just did the same thing. They just reelected a state party chairman who was all in for Trump from day one of Trump's 2016 cycle. You know, somebody who has been very destructive, I would say, to the concept of truth and credibility and integrity when it comes to the party. And it is a question of separating out party leadership, party activists, you know, the people who kind of activate the party, as opposed to the thousands or tens of thousands of people who identify as Republican on election day. I haven't seen any current polling, but I know that I can tell you that in 2016, Donald Trump lost New Hampshire by a couple of thousand votes. He lost New Hampshire in 2020 by tens of thousands of votes. So there's clearly a movement away from him amongst a population of decent, clear-thinking human beings, even at the same time while the party itself is going deeper and deeper in for Trump. And that's where it becomes a problem for the party.
And Jennifer, I do want to say you said decent, clear-thinking human beings. I do want to clarify you. It sounds like you're saying that people who voted for him are not decent human beings.
No,
I want to give you a chance to clarify on that.
Yes, I will clarify that. Because here's something I've said all along with all of this, is that part of the problem that has to be solved is that we have to understand why so many otherwise good people are voting for Donald Trump. We have to understand what it is that those Americans are experiencing, what the struggle is, what the fear is, you know, what is it that kind of, what are the experiences that have created such a large base of support for him? But in this particular case, when we are talking about those people who are actively engaged in leading the party structure, chairman, national committee men, you know, state committee people, and congressmen and senators, these people who are feeding the lie that Donald Trump, that this election was stolen from Donald Trump, are engaged in a full frontal assault against democracy, against the republic. And we saw on January 6th how perilously close, to how fragile that democracy is. That cannot be excused or soft-pedaled in any way. That's what's happening within the Republican Party right now.
I want to go to the phones here. I will grab a couple of calls, 800-423-8255. We've got Anya on the line from Cambridge. Anya, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I am wondering whether you could comment on the thought of just having more than one Republican Party. Why can we not have a very right-wing and a more centrally oriented party that focuses on the traditional Republican values? I understand it would potentially trade in a lot of oomph and power when it comes to general elections. But then if the same is true for the Democratic Party, we would be forced innately to create coalitions and compromise and get out of this gridlock of having just two big parties who, it seems to me, do not really capture anymore, the voters that they captured before.
Anya, thank you for that. I'm going to grab one more. Bob in Arlington. Bob, go ahead.
Hi. I'm tired of hearing how many Republicans don't believe Donald Trump and behind the scenes say such things. But instead of leading and teaching the mob that's following these lies, they cave in. So they're more worried about getting reelected. But that's not living up to their oath of office. Why don't they lead? Politicians know more than we do. Their place is to educate and let people know why they vote a certain way.
All right. Thank you for that, Bob. So, Jennifer, Anthony, I'm mindful of time. Here's what I'm going to do. Anthony, to Bob's question, we do hear a gap between, you're a senior political reporter. We hear Republican officials in private expressing sentiments we don't hear them expressing in public.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Tiziana, I was like so focused on your first caller, and I sort of was putting an answer together for
that. Well, do that,
so
then,
Anthony. I'm going to respond that way. Yeah, just really quickly, this idea of another party, I mean, that there's already talk of that. I mean, there are Republican leaders in states like Texas and Wisconsin who are talking about breaking away and sort of forming a pro-Trump faction. Donald Trump himself is talking about now, we understand from reporting, that he's talking about setting up something called the Patriot Party. Now, that might be aimed at putting pressure on Republicans in the coming election to sort of stay loyal to him. But this idea of the Republican Party actually fracturing is something that you can find a lot of historical precedents for. Historians that I spoke to for this reporting I did last week talk about the fact that political parties don't last forever. And probably the coalition that the Republican Party represented in 2015 between people like Jennifer Horne, principled conservatives, and other pro-Trump folks, it's just probably not going to last, until 2025. Yeah. So I see that as a likely route.
You are listening to Radio Boston with Jennifer Horne, the former chair of the New Hampshire GOP and a co-founder of the Lincoln Project, and WBUR's Anthony Brooks. I'm Tiziana Deering. So, Jennifer Horne, two calls there, one about forming new parties, one about the difference between what we're hearing from elected Republican leaders privately and publicly. Your thoughts before we wrap here.
Well, you know, that second call in particular went right to why I left the party, and I'm now a registered independent, and it kind of reflects to the first woman's question as well. Are these both of our parties, we have so much focus on the Republican Party right now because of Trump, but the truth is the party system is broken, and what we need is some mechanism, some action, something that is going to force each of these parties to come back to the center and recognize that they're going to lose votes, they're going to lose power if they don't come together and work together and start to solve the problems of the day. And that's why I became an independent as opposed to joining the Democratic Party or staying with the Republican Party. It has become so much, you look at someone like Mitch McConnell, it has become so much about just holding power. It's not about serving the people. It's not about solving problems. To Anthony's point, I do think that the Republican Party is at risk of, at the beginning of the end for them, perhaps, throughout the history of our country. You know, political parties don't last forever. They change with the times. And the Republican Party right now is regressing. They are going back to principles and foundational ideas, trying to build a future on ideas that had long since been rejected by the American people. I don't see how they can possibly move forward with that. This may very well be the beginning of what becomes the end of the party.
Anthony Brooks, do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, and you'll find Republicans, and I found them in the story that I reported last week, who say the problem with the idea of the Republican Party splintering is that sort of means a decade or longer in the political wilderness, because you're just not going to have the votes. I talked to one former Republican chair of the Republican Party in Massachusetts, and she said, whether you like it or not, Trump got nearly 75 million votes. Their votes count, and we've got to figure out a way to get everyone into the big tent. Now, I know Jennifer Horne would disagree with that, but, you know, this was a point of view that said we need the Jennifer Hornes back. We need to find a place for the Trump supporters in order to stay viable. But the question we keep coming back to, can that party be viable? And that's an open question.
Well, that is a question.
And I just have to jump in really quickly.
Very briefly,
whenever anybody
Jennifer,
talks about 74 million votes, I have to remind them Joe Biden got 80 million. Like this, there's such a divide right now in our country,
yep.
But it is on the side of decency that is advancing, that is, you know, holding the lead here.
All right. That is Jennifer Horne, former chair of the New Hampshire GOP and co-founder of the Lincoln Project, and WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that, folks, is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. Do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.